From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. An hour before President Bush strode into the White House East Room for last week's primetime news conference, the press corps was gathered outside the press room annex of the West Wing, waiting for the high sign to head across the lawn. Then, says Bob Deans, Cox Newspapers correspondent and president of the White House Correspondents Association,
we were told, you may as well come back in because we're going to call you out two by two to take you over to the East Room.
The reporters complied. And not a whole lot changed when the conference actually began. President Bush used the occasion of only his second primetime Q&A in the 2 years of his presidency to state and restate his determination to disarm Iraq. He called on 18 reporters in a sequence predetermined by the White House and was often so evasive in his answers that when he offhandedly observed that the order of questioning was scripted, it seemed he was referring to the entire event. Bob Deans.
Unfortunately, I think that a lot of the audience, and the reason I know this is because I've probably gotten about 24 emails from people all around the country, you know, chastising me and saying, you know, you guys are a bunch of lapdogs. You sat there and let him go through with a scripted news conference. That's not what happened, but it certainly, I can understand why people would have thought that.
Viewers heard a series of perfectly good, if perfunctory, questions on the cost of an Iraq war, on the Korean nuclear crisis, on why many NATO allies have a less alarmist interpretation of U.S. intelligence than we have, and on the future of Saddam Hussein. In one of the evening's rare follow-ups, a reporter dissatisfied with President Bush's evasive answer to that question gamely tried again.
Can success contingent upon capturing or killing Saddam Hussein in your mind?
We will be changing the regime of Iraq for the good of the Iraqi people. Bill Plant.
For the most part, however, the assembled journalists listened to the president's non-responses and quietly sat down. Enraged over such docility, the New York Press called the news conference an historic political catastrophe and a mini-Alamo for American journalism. It's a point worth arguing. What's inarguable about last week's 45-minute episode of East Wing, says CBS News White House correspondent Bill Plant, is that the president was on message.
He gave pretty much the same answer to all questions.
My job is to protect the American people. My job is to protect America.
Since my most important job is to protect the security of the American people. That's precisely what we'll do.
It gave people the impression that the whole thing was a charade. I don't think it was quite that bad.
Plant, the 22-year White House veteran, laughs not out of delight, but more like resignation.
It's frustrating. We're props. But, you know, you deal with the situation as you find it, and you try to best it when you can and live with it when you can't.
It's difficult to be appalled because it's just sort of, it's very much the routine for us. So we're sort of perhaps not accepting of the fact, but very much used to the fact that it's just not possible to procure information from this administration.
Dana Milbank covers the White House for The Washington Post and has long chafed at the administration's obsessive control over information and has been known to confront the White House in print over the question of access. But like many reporters on the beat, he says that the format of the nationally televised news conference does not lend itself to confrontation.
You can imagine that if somebody said, look, Mr. President, this is a charade, you haven't answered the question, that would produce an incredible public backlash.
The Cox Newspaper's Bob Deans.
There were probably 60 reporters in the room. No one did it. But what I would say is that this is a president who has put a premium on a certain amount of protocol and respect. This is a guy who, if you holler out a question to him during a pool setting, you will get a glare, and you can be sure he will not call on you. He will not recognize your question. He won't answer it. And so our behavior, to a certain extent, reflects those realities.
If that sounds like a reporter who has been intimidated or beaten down or simply tamed by the presidency, media critic Jack Schaefer is one who just shrugs, because to Schaefer, a columnist for Slate, it was ever thus.
I say from the get-go, the televised news conference has been the president's chosen method to go over the heads of the press and get whatever message he has to the public. John Kennedy may have been more suave and might have had a more comedic flair, But there's nothing new. You can't force somebody to answer a question he's not going to answer. You remember that press conference when Richard Nixon said to Dan Rather,
"Are you running for something?" "No, sir, Mr. President, are you?"
The blowback was on Rather, not on the president.
Yeah, that really stunted Rather's career. In the relationship between an elected politician and the proxies for the electorate, the only one who's supposed to be worrying about blowback or popularity is the politician. Yet, in speaking to me, several reporters made reference to the negative impression such aggressive questioning leaves with viewers, recalling that in Operation Desert Storm, for instance, live news briefings made reporters look rude, stupid, and disrespectful. Well, so what? Sausage making is not meant to be as appetizing as sausage. The real issue is war, or the brink of war, a time for bashfulness or deference? One reporter used her precious presidential question to lob a 73-mile-an-hour fastball right down the middle of the plate.
"Mr. President, as the nation is at odds over war, with many organizations like the Congressional Black Caucus pushing for continued diplomacy through the UN, how is your faith guiding you?"
The president smiled. "I appreciate the question a lot," he said. And there is no doubt that he did.
As dozens of reporters chafe in the gilded cage of the White House press room, hundreds more are flowing into the Middle East, many embedded with the U.S. military. NPR's John Burnett is one of those. We spoke to him last week from the splendor of the Kuwaiti Hilton. Now he's living in the desert at the Marine camp called Matilda. When we called him this week, it was midnight in Kuwait. He spoke low into his satellite phone so as not to disturb the sleeping soldiers he's coming to know.
It's a wonderful group of guys because they all belong to the Marine Band. So they're all musicians. They're not quite the warriors that you get with other Marine platoons. I'm actually staying in the band tent, but I'll be covering the two-star general and the colonels that actually run this enormous division, which will be one of the spearheads as the invasion of Iraq begins, if it begins.
If it begins, is there much talk, given what's been going on in the UN, among the people you're with, about the possibility that it may not begin or may not begin anytime soon?
When you're around a bunch of 19-year-old Marines, they're extremely impatient to get going and to start fighting, even if they play tubas and clarinets. Everyone in this camp is completely gung-ho about invading Iraq. One of the staff sergeants, when a fellow held up some Iraqi currency with a picture of Saddam Hussein on it, he pulled out his 9mm pistol, unloaded it, cocked it, and then shot it at the image of Saddam inside the stall in one of the porta-johns here. Someone has drawn a picture of downtown Baghdad in flames. This is a group of soldiers that really wants to get moving.
What about your fellow journalists? Has some of that gung-ho spirit found its way into that cadre?
When we live in the same conditions that these thousands and thousands of soldiers do, which is sandstorms, sleeping on the floors of tents, the fine dust, the consistency of talcum powder everywhere, this is what the Marines like to call an austere environment. I would say that you may start having journalists who left the United States as doves turning into, if not hawks, at least blue jays.
I remember last week you were a little skeptical about the presence of a Marine buddy to help you along your news gathering tasks. Has your buddy presented himself?
Yes, in fact. The U.S. Marine Corps has assigned me my Marine buddy. He's a very sweet young corporal, looks like to be about 19 years old. His name is Quana, and he is anything but a censor or a minder or anything that we would associate with trying to spin the content of what I'm doing. If anything, he's here to help me get my gas mask on when we have chem bio alerts. He's here to show me around the camp. And so far, I'm really encouraged that the military is following through with what they said they were going to do. I mean, I've only actually been out here in the desert with the troops for 3 days now. But in those 3 days, we've met the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division. We've met the chief of staff. We've met the assistant commander. They've all said, what can we do to help you do your job? Which is just not something you really expect from the Department of Defense. So I'm encouraged so far.
Are there any concerns that remain as you look ahead to covering a possible war?
Well, in a sense, I mean, this is all a dress rehearsal, Brooke. Nothing really matters until the war starts, and then everything matters because everything starts in earnest, and we find out whether the war plan is working, whether there have been terrible mistakes, whether there have been dramatic casualties, whether there have been civilian deaths. And all these things are very difficult for the Pentagon as an institution, you know, to talk about. And so I'm very interested to see how forthcoming they will be, but there are certainly some encouraging signs of openness.
What about the job that you have to do now? As you say, this is a dress rehearsal. Are there any stories that you've reported that you felt needed to be reported?
Well, I'm actually doing sort of Ernie Pyle stories right now of these Marines and who they are and how they feel about the possible coming battle and what their lives are like out here. I mean, frankly, there's been so much about potential military tactics and so many pundits predicting what's going to happen. I'm pretty sick of that. And the little war reporting that I've done has told me that so much of what generals and colonels say about a coming war, about what they're going to do and how strong they are and what their forces can accomplish, it's all propaganda that is aimed at the enemy to confound them, confuse them, to scare them. This is also why I'm not really interested in doing a lot of quoting from some of the top commanders right now. They can't say a whole lot about what the battle is going to look like, and what they can say, you do have to be aware of the propaganda purposes. In some ways, it's easier to focus on the troops right now.
John, thank you so much.
It's good to be here, Brooke.
NPR's John Burnett speaking to us from Camp Matilda in northern Kuwait.
Coming up, when the press keeps mum. Sometimes it's squeamishness, sometimes it's bullets, sometimes it's simple starvation.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. At the beginning of March, the Observer of London ran with the scoop that the U.S. National Security Agency had wiretapped several officials at the UN whose nations would be crucial votes on whether to support an invasion of Iraq. A leaked report suggests that Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Bulgaria, Guinea, and Pakistan were bugged, presumably to give the U.S. a leg up in precarious negotiations where few votes for war can be entirely relied upon.
Big news? Seems so. Most of the networks and the cable news channels booked interviews with the Observer reporters, but abruptly canceled them when the Drudge Report and the Washington Times, both news outlets with a strong right-wing tilt, cast doubt on the leak's authenticity. After experts weighed in suggesting that it was, in fact, genuine, the networks never called back. Some major papers have reported the story, but the prevailing take is that this is business as usual at the UN, nothing to get worked up about. As of Friday, it had yet to appear as a story in the New York Times or on NPR. Daniel Ellsberg joins me now. An unauthorized docudrama of his historic leak of the Pentagon Papers aired last week on the FX cable channel. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So tell me where you were when you first saw this story about the bugging of the UN.
In fact, I was working late and looking at the Internet, and I was absolutely thunderstruck by this story because it wasn't just a scoop. It was the reproduction of an actual operational memo from NSA indicating that somebody, probably in British intelligence, which seemed to have been one of the recipients of the memo, had leaked it, which meant a kind of revolt in the intelligence establishment that I'd never seen. The idea in the U.S. press that it's a ho-hum matter, I think actually reveals how thoroughly the U.S., a lot of the U.S. press, is into what could be called an imperial mentality, kind of condescending. Of course we do it to them, whereas if they were to do it to us, it would certainly be big news.
You've said that you regard this leak as being of even greater importance than the Pentagon Papers. Well, the Pentagon Papers laid out decades of official lying. This bugging doesn't point out any lies. It just talks about a certain amount of diplomatic indiscretion on the part of U.S. intelligence.
The Pentagon Papers, they did end before the Nixon administration actually got into office. So they were history. I never really believed they had a high chance of affecting the war. I just thought that they might help. And the initial effect was very small, actually. My feeling is that this leak, by the possibility of actually affecting votes in the UN Security Council, is extremely timely and has the possibility, the potential, for actually averting a war before the bombing starts.
I don't think it needs to be said that you're strongly opposed to this war. And in the course of this interview, we're not going to argue the case for or against. Mm-hmm. But I know that you have made a general call to all potential leakers out there to make information known, presumably information that does not jeopardize national security, to inform the debate on the war.
There hasn't been much of a debate, really. You know, there were no hearings in Congress. I think that the administration is meeting complaints from Congress that they're concealing information on the costs of the war, on the probable numbers of U.S. deaths and of Iraqi deaths, on the length of the occupation, the scale of the occupation. And I think that before the bombs fall, this is the time, this week, next week, where truth on those matters, putting out the estimates that do exist and giving them to Congress as they've asked, at the risk of the personal career and even the freedom of the people who do that, that would be as timely as this leak from Britain.
Now, in the days of the Pentagon Papers, the press was ultimately vindicated by the Supreme Court. If the press were to show that kind of backbone today, do you think it's likely the court would support it?
Whether they would support the First Amendment as much as before is a question. Whether Ashcroft, as Attorney General, would try to bring injunctions if he were faced with the NSA leak, for example, I really have little doubt that if he'd had a chance to stop that leak, he would have gone for an injunction. And as for prosecutions, there's no question they would certainly be going for prosecutions then.
Before we go, let me throw in a question about your movie, the one that appeared on the FX cable network.
It's not my movie. It's a movie about me.
And so how does it stand up as history?
As history, in detail, very bad. If they'd followed my book, which they didn't have, they would have had a much more accurate story, but it wouldn't necessarily have been a better movie. This one was a good story, and it had the basic outlines of my own change of heart. So I think this movie has the potential for encouraging whistleblowing, and I'd like it to be seen on every computer screen in the Pentagon and the CIA and the State Department if there was a way of hacking it into them. I think it would give them very useful food for thought.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Former Defense Department official Daniel Ellsberg faced 115 years in prison when he leaked the Pentagon Papers.
The struggle for press freedom in Haiti has been a long and dangerous one, full of victories and setbacks, and at times, utter tragedy. Like 3 years ago when radio journalist Jean Dominique, a hero of the free press movement, was murdered in the courtyard of his beloved station, Radio Haiti. Dominique's widow, Michelle Montas, has taken up his fight and run Radio Haiti since his death. For several years, his words of defiance could still be heard on the air.
They have tried everything to sink us, to electrocute us, to drown us, to seduce us. This has lasted more than 50 years. Is there a reason it should stop? Yes, one. Things must change in Haiti.
But recently, the struggle for press freedom has faced yet another setback after a failed assassination attempt on her own life and mounting death threats against her reporters. Michelle Montas has pulled Radio Haiti off the air. Michelle Montas, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob.
When we first heard from you in a report that aired on our program back in March 2001, it seemed like journalism in Haiti was under a very serious attack. A year after your husband's murder, there were death threats against other journalists at your station and elsewhere, and threats to burn down the station. And now on Christmas Day, an attempt was made on your life. You survived the assassination attempt. Your bodyguard didn't. But only now you have pulled Radio Haiti off the air. Why now?
We realized that the danger was not just on me. The danger was on everyone. I did it because I felt that we had to protect lives. We have lost 3 lives in 3 years. That's a lot. I was no longer willing to go to another funeral. And we decided that the only way to stop this right now was just to stop broadcasting.
You've said that the suspension of your transmissions is temporary. What will it take for Radio Haiti to go back on the air?
In the case of Radio Haiti, we have one specific set of circumstances. The reason I think that there was the assassination attempt on me at Christmas time was essentially because they had announced that they would have the final accusation indictments in my husband's case. And these indictments were supposed to come out at the end of December, which might explain why they attempted to kill me on December 25th. Until now, those indictments have not come out yet. They are supposed to come out next week, which is one further reason why I think the danger's at a very high level. We feel that we have to wait for those indictments to come out to find out exactly who is implicated in the murder. And I think from there, we'll find out who is trying to kill me. And we'll find out who is trying to force Radio Haiti to drop a number of subjects, which I guess worry some people.
Well, what about those subjects? You have reported and your late husband reported on corruption in the regime of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This regime was supposed to be the democratic alternative to the years of repression under the Duvaliers, but some things, I guess, in Haiti never change.
That's true. A few things, of course, have changed to the extent that we don't have censorship the way we did when we worked under Duvalier at Radio Haiti. We don't have open repression on the press on the part of the government as we did during the coup, which was from 1991 to 1994. However, now we have forces, people in the streets, armed people, who think that they can, you know, force anyone into silence. If a journalist says anything that they don't like, they can threaten that journalist, and there will be no punishment to them. So it has been really kind of an open season against not only journalists, but against anyone expressing ideas that are against the party in power.
There are other radio stations in Haiti, perhaps not as significant politically as Radio Haiti, but they're nonetheless. What are they doing with you off the air? Anything more substantial or just status quo?
We know that there is a radio station where they have started counting days. You know, for the last 3 years, I've been counting days. Every day I've been saying good morning to my husband, every day counting the number of days since he was assassinated. And they have picked up, since we stopped broadcasting, one radio station has started counting, but the other way around. It has been one day since Radio Haiti had to shut down. It has been 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and they keep it up. You know, radio journalists feel very endangered by the fact that Radio Haiti had to close. It is a symbol of the situation that most journalists face. Because of a general climate of threats against the press. The idea is that if you break the thermometer, maybe you will change the temperature. And you have right now a level of self-censorship. And in fact, when I think of the type of journalism we were doing at Radio Haiti, investigative reporting, I don't think there is any room right now for investigative reporting. I remember recently we covered the story of one congressman that had been assassinated by a known gunman, and it touched people close to the party in power. And right now, I don't think any station could do it.
I want to change the subject a little bit. The director, Jonathan Demme, has made a documentary about your struggle, and particularly your late husband's struggle. It's a film called The Agronomist. Your husband, Jean-Dominique, was trained as an agronomist. He became a journalist only later in life. But the film isn't about agronomy.
Well, it's about not only the struggle of a man for democracy. I think it's the struggle of the country for democracy. And he has covered the years from the 70s when, Radio 80 was on the air until now. And the whole story is about the love of a man for a land, for a country. And that's why he kept the title The Agronomist.
I'm going to ask a difficult question. I don't mean for it to sound indicting, but I must ask it nonetheless. If this film, The Agronomist, is about a movement and a people who refused to be intimidated, how should we regard the irony of the possibility that the film will debut for world audiences and Radio Haiti won't even be on the air to speak about it?
Radio Haiti stopped broadcasting from 1980 to 1986. We went back on the air then. We went back on the air again in 1994 after stopping to broadcast for 4 years. We haven't stopped fighting. I think our silence is a way of fighting. The fact that we stopped broadcasting is putting pressure on the government to an extent that is maybe even more important than actually speaking out, to the extent that right now they are going to be forced to come out with indictments in the case of Jean-Dominique. So I don't think it is...
So the silence is deafening.
It is. It is. I think it's louder than words.
Michel Montas, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Michel Montas is the news director of Radio Haiti and the widow of Haitian journalism martyr Jean-Dominique.
It took Dutch journalist Peter Tetero 6 years to gain entry to North Korea, a country that has been without anything resembling a free press for more than half a century. When he arrived with his co-director Raymond Fedema, an expert on the region, they were herded like cattle from one monument to another, speaking to no one but government-approved tour guides, and with footage that amounted to little more than a relentlessly choreographed travelogue, they crafted a documentary in which the pictures are constantly at war with the narration. Their film called Welcome to North Korea airs on Cinemax this Tuesday. Tetero says they got into the country by posing as part of a scientific delegation eager to see the glories of Pyongyang.
We had two small cameras looking as amateur cameras. And as long as we were filming things that are contributing to the picture they want to portray, it was fine with them. You go to exhibits, you go to museums where everything looks perfect. And what we tried to do in the film is have the Koreans show it their way and count on the interpretation from a Western audience to see how different reality is from the way the North Koreans try to portray it.
I understood the peculiar and almost impossible situation you were in as a documentarian, having to deal with footage that had nothing to do with the truth and little to do with the story that you wanted to tell. Nevertheless, I felt that you were, maybe the expression is gilding the lily. Let me give you an example. There was some amazing footage that you managed to get, secret footage, of the towns that you weren't allowed to go to, at least one town, where you saw starving people boiling roots and eating bark, clearly on the point of death. And the footage was very disturbing and didn't need a soundtrack, but you added one anyway.
The people in the country are suffering in silence and dying. Scenes filmed in secret of people cooking tree bark and clay just to have something in their stomachs.
How did you come upon that footage?
We got it from a Chinese relief organization.
And why do you think you needed to add the ominous music behind the scenes that were already so full of despair?
Yeah, well, that's a matter of taste, I think. In this stage, I decided to use this music, and I think it contributed to the whole atmosphere. But maybe one can argue that it was a bit much.
Maybe it is simply a question of different news styles after all. But when you're getting a rare glimpse of a nation that has been, as you note, shrouded in mystery for so long, whose image has been spun not only to outsiders but its own people, don't you worry that you need to be even more cautious about how you describe and present the images that you bring back?
Of course. You know, it's always the responsibility of journalists to make sure that you don't exaggerate what you're trying to show to people. It's always trying to find a balance between saying enough and not saying enough, and you're trying to make sure that you can bring it in front of an audience, people that are not necessarily interested in what's going on in this country. And I have to persuade them. I have to get them into this story. And, of course, one can always argue that you overdo it. One can always argue that you should not add that much music or strong words or whatever to this picture. But, you know, when you realize that you're one of the few that are able to go to a country which is so isolated to keep up your cover, then this is the maximum one can do, I think. And, of course, this will never be the ultimate film about North Korea, but it's one of the first films about North Korea. And to me, that's much more exciting, even.
Probably the most chilling bit of footage was a bit of archival tape. It was, I guess, at the countrywide mourning after the death of who they called the great leader, Kim Il-sung, back in 1994. The citizens were beating their breasts and wailing and moaning, and it was hard to tell whether this was merely more choreography or the cries of a bereaved nation. Let's hear a little of that. Knowing what you know about North Korea after your time there, do you think that was real, or do you think that that was for show?
I think mostly it is real. On the day Kim Il-sung passed away, I was sent as a reporter to Raymond Fedema, because he is an expert, to interview him about how can they force that many people to mourn, you know, with a gun on their head, as a matter of speaking. And he said, no, those people are not all of them forced. This is the way they are brought up. They are brainwashed to a standard which we cannot imagine. And this, of course, is even worse than being forced. And when he explained it to me, that was the moment I thought I want to go to that country.
Peter Tetereau, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Peter Tetereau is the co-director of Welcome to North Korea that airs this Tuesday on Cinemax.
Coming up, when pundits doubt themselves and Rolodex cards revolt.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Something wondrous strange is happening in the world of punditry, the columnists and commentators whose job it is to chew over the news and spit out insights. A group of opinion makers who were once reluctant hawks are now turning into reluctant doves. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman has completed that transformation, for example, and it looks like former intelligence official Kenneth Pollack, author of The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, is well on the way. Slate columnist Mickey Kaus hit on this phenomenon in his Kaus Files. He calls this group of conscience-ridden waverers the Balking Hawks, or the Balkenhawken, or the Coalition of the Chillen. Mickey Kaus joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Tell us how the major columnists were positioning themselves prior to the shift that you wrote about in Balking Hawks.
Well, the most prominent would be the New York Times' Thomas Friedman, who was pretty hawkish. I mean, he was anguished, but he always said at the end he believed that an invasion was the right thing to do. And now with what's going on in the UN, he has had a pretty striking case of cold feet, and he now calls for cutting some sort of deal. He'd be the most prominent. Others would be Josh Marshall, who has a weblog called Talking Points, who was very hawkish and was a big proponent of the war and has now had cold feet, and Fred Kaplan at Slate, who has also endorsed a proposal similar to Friedman's. By far the most prominent would be Kenneth Pollack himself, who wrote a very influential book.
Pollack's book, of course, was subtitled The Case for Invading Iraq.
Right, and he has now distanced himself from the subtitle of his book. He hasn't abandoned his position, which is we should reluctantly, with appropriate anguish, invade Iraq. But he has sort of cast this sort of anchor to the left, as it were, by saying, well, my editors made me do it, which is troubling.
What about Jonathan Alter in Newsweek or Joe Klein in Time?
I would say they fall into a slightly different category that tends to morph into the first, but they haven't abandoned their support for the war, but they have focused their fire on Bush and how he's botching it and he's being undiplomatic. I would be more convinced if they actually said, well, given the French opposition, would they go forward or wouldn't they go forward? I mean, that's the decision facing the president.
So what's going on here? What events have led once hawkish columnists to change their tune?
The basic event that's led people to change their tune is the difficulty of getting approval from the Security Council and the evident unpopularity of the American position, not just in the Security Council, but in popular opinion around the world, which is part of what's driving the Security Council. That's caused some people to have second thoughts. But there's some other, perhaps subconscious, phenomena at work. One, there's sort of a stylistic distancing. If you're on the left and you wind up endorsing President Bush, you sort of have to cover yourself by criticizing Bush as you agree with him. You say, well, I don't like his cowboy style. I don't think he's too smart, but I agree with him. The second would be the CYA phenomenon, which is you're sort of covering yourself. If the war goes badly, you can say, well, you know, I didn't quite go along all the way. I said we should do X, Y, and Z beforehand. And that's also sort of a moral covering. And the third thing that happens is when you agonize, you're more convincing. So part of the anguish and the second guessing and the cold feet is functional for opinion shapers.
I don't know, though. That makes it sound as if these are things that happen all the time during times of interesting news, shall we say. But it strikes me that it's pretty unusual for columnists to reconsider, at least so many of them. Don't you think that this could simply be an honest reaction to new information coming to light?
I think basically everybody is sincerely trying to make up their minds. I'm not saying people are acting in bad faith, but there are these subconscious impulses to CYA and to distance yourself that operate in all of us, too. And I think they operate with every decision, and they're just magnified in this case because the decision is so momentous. The gamble we're taking is so momentous.
Now, you mentioned a half dozen columnists. Among them, certainly the most influential would be Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. But surely there are plenty of other well-known columnists who have held true to their positions all through this debate. How important do you think, in the greater scheme of things, are the ones who have changed their tune?
That's a very good question. I think Friedman is important. I think if Friedman is changing his mind, it should send a warning signal to the Bush administration. I do tend to think that, in general, most opinions wash out and turn out not to have been significant. But the weight of opinion, of collective pundit opinion, has a huge impact in Washington.
Do you think that columnists are influenced by input from their readers?
Very much so. I mean, you'd be surprised at how much people are influenced by input from their readers, from people they meet on the street, from their friends, from emails they get. People are human beings, and they're, you know, influenced by the last person they talk to.
Well, Mickey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mickey Kaus is the author of the weblog Kaus Files, which you can find on Slate.com.
Major Strasser has been shot. Round up the usual suspects.
Here's the difference between Captain Renault, prefect of Casablanca Police, and the media. Renault had a whistle. Otherwise, the methodology is pretty much the same. A story breaks, expert analysis is required, turn to the Rolodex and round up the usual suspects. If it's a legal issue, find Alan Dershowitz. If it's an FBI investigation, call ex-G-man James Kallstrom. Conservative politics, William Crystal. Advertising? Well, modesty forbids.
Are there any advertisers that would say that O.J. Simpson could be good for them?
Not any advertiser of substance. This endorsement business is not just about name recognition and notoriety. It's about respect and credibility and likability. And O.J. is never going to regain that. 70% of the American people still thinks the guy got away with murder. It's just not going to happen. You know, they could acquit the Menendez brothers, too, but they're not going to be the Doublemint twins.
Did whoever called me to book that interview call me because I was involved in the O.J. story? No. Because I'd written something especially trenchant on the subject? No. Because I was just the right person to provide context and detail? No. It was because the story concerned advertising pitchmen, and in her Rolodex under A for advertising, she found my name. And it happens every day in broadcast and print thousands and thousands of times, with varying degrees of suitability and a whole lot of deja vu. Robert Thompson is a professor of journalism and mass media at Syracuse University.
Because journalism goes off at the alarmingly quick rate that it does, people do collect Rolodexes. They're people they know they can get a hold of on a moment's notice. And I think there is this kind of aristocracy of commentators that gets created as a result of it.
I myself have landed in that Burke's peerage of punditry, but there's another one of my peers who is really without peer. He is Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and probably the most quoted non-government official in Washington. He may be listed in a lot of Rolodexes under P for politics and, say, C for Congress. He should be under O, not for Ornstein, but for O negative. He's the universal donor, spilling his life's blood 2,000 to 3,000 times a year. He's been flooded with calls about homeland security, but...
I've had calls on the budget. I've done phone calls on Ben Gilman. I've done things on the farm bill.
You get the point. And Ornstein gets the calls because he's a dependable source on damn near anything, which is handy, but in terms of broadening debate on a given subject, not necessarily ideal. Furthermore, there's the question of actual reporting versus just filling in the blanks. Not to point any fingers, but let's just say it isn't too hard to write a story before conducting an interview, leaving spaces with notations like Ornstein quote here. The king of quotes himself acknowledges that.
I find now, compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago, a lot more laziness on the part of reporters, people who turn to the same sources because they pretty much know what they're going to get and there isn't any use in looking around.
The result, says Professor Thompson, is the usual suspects phenomenon, which for all its advantages to reporters and producers can be antithetical to genuine inquiry.
I think the Rolodex in the end becomes part of the, is one of the most important tools in the toolbox of a good journalist. I think what we may be looking for is a need for that Rolodex to have a more diverse set of voices within it.
For instance, a search of the New York Times database for the past 2 years yields 42 stories, quoting consumer advocate Gene Kimmelman, head of the Washington Office of the Consumers Union. Now, Washington is just lousy with consumer advocates, but Kimmelman rules. Of course, the Times has nothing on the Washington Post, which in the same period quoted Kimmelman 58 times, including on January 23rd, 2001, an astonishing 3 times in 3 separate stories, all on section fronts. That's right, the coveted trifecta. Kimmelman chuckled over his breakfast. Meanwhile, in the Washington Post newsroom, reporter Peter Goodman ambivalently accepted the congratulations of his colleagues because while Kimmelman was the horse that won 3 races in 1 day, Goodman was the jockey in the mount. Yes, one reporter wrote all 3 stories, quoting the same man.
It's both an anomaly and a symptom of a larger problem. There's no question that the beat reporter in Washington is harried and frantic and is too prone to doing the easiest thing, which in this case was reaching someone who's, you know, delightfully easy to get a hold of and who gives good quote. So for that, I'm guilty. We, the members of the media, are guilty. And, I could have, let's be real. You know, I should have worked harder to get some other voices in the paper.
You can't much fault Goodman, to switch back to Professor Thompson's metaphor, if he is guilty of nothing more than using the right tool for the job on three separate jobs that happen to coincide. If the job calls for a hammer, you grab a hammer. What reporters and producers need to do, Thompson says, is to keep a large and diverse toolbox so that they're not using a hammer to put in a screw. Strangely, the biggest toolboxes of all probably belong to cable news. For all its notorious sensationalism and superficiality, cable may provide more diversity of expert analysis than the largest newspapers, owing not to its nuanced coverage, we know it doesn't provide that, but simply to its insatiable appetite for ever more experts to fill all those chairs on camera 24 hours a day. Each network has a central database of 50,000 names. So precious is his Rolodex collection to Fox News Channel's chief booker Eric Spinato that each evening before he leaves work, he places his under lock and key.
It could be a janitor. I don't know who's looking through my Rolodexes. They could, again, take someone's home number that if they trusted me with it, how am I? I'm being negligent by leaving it out for others to scour through.
Imagine this scenario. You're at the beach. Your wife is standing with her back to the ocean. Next to her are your seven Rolodexes. You see a huge wave gathering, and it's just about to break. What do you do?
Grab the Rolodexes in one hand and grab the wife's hand on the other and leave. The Rolodex is our life.
That's because while the problems of two people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world, the fate of 50,000 experts and pundits could affect the Hannity and Combs show and special report with Brit Hume and the O'Reilly Factor. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday and for the rest of your life.
How do Rolodex cards sleep at night? Sometimes not very well, according to one lapsed expert named Stephen Moss. Writing in the latest issue of Legal Affairs, he recalls making a lot of money the newfangled way, as an expert in courtrooms and TV shows, oftentimes espousing positions he didn't care about or even believe. Today, Moss is still an expert, though he's paid far less for it. He now testifies on issues he genuinely understands and supports. Stephen Moss, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, along with the lower pay, was your tell-all in Legal Affairs part of your penance? Did you feel a lot better getting it off your chest?
Well, truthfully, I did. And actually, the article as I first wrote it was much more of a confession than the article that ultimately came out. But I did want to publicly say that I'm sorry.
Now, you began your career in expertry, for lack of a better word, as a maven on freight train safety. Can you explain how that happened?
What normally happens as an expert witness in analytical cases, legal cases, or just public policy is that a group looks for somebody who can become their, let's say, mouthpiece. And in general, they want someone who both can talk the talk, but also can do some analysis about what have become very complex issues in public policy. So in the case of rail safety, I was hired by a group that was very interested in promoting rail safety, which seems like a good thing. And the way they framed the issue was that there is a problem with rail safety, and Steve, go find out what that problem is. And so I did. And in general, when you ask a question, there's always an answer to it. And I found the answers that they liked, and then they went about promoting that position.
And then it began to expand, and you became an expert on passenger trains as well.
Well, after a while, when you're an expert in one thing, you quickly morph into being an expert on all things like that. So I did research on freight trains, mostly, but there was pretty big interest in passenger trains, so I quickly became an expert on that as well.
And your first big media appearance was as an expert on the Today Show, and you wrote in your Legal Affairs piece, "It was over in a matter of minutes, but my discomfort has lasted to this day." How come?
Well, at that time, I had done a lot of research and analysis on a ballot initiative here in California that was oriented toward the environment. Now, the ballot initiative wasn't a well-written one, so there were lots of problems with it, but my job was to help kill it. And helping to kill it mostly meant pointing out its economic problems, like how it would devastate the state economically. Now, there was some truth to that, but that kind of discussion doesn't really get you into a discussion about the trade-offs between environmental protection and economics or what the long-run future of California should be. It's not a very rich discussion. And so I had a hammer, and the nail was the environment, and so I hit it.
You noted that the experience, whether or not you were being questioned by attorneys or by reporters, was pretty much the same because they knew the answer that they wanted before they asked the question. Was it your job as an expert to provide that answer, the one they were fishing for? And have you ever, I won't say lied, misdirected?
No, my job was not to answer the reporter's questions or the attorney's questions. My job in all cases is to promote the answers my client wants me to promote. So if a reporter asks me a question that's off the bullet points that I was given by the client, I'm not going to answer it that way unless I have to. And an example that I think I recounted in the article is that I was asked by a reporter whether or not train safety should be considered one of the highest transportation risks in the country. And after a brief pause, I said yes, though the answer is probably more like no, because the agenda was that train safety is something we need more attention to.
Now, when you first ventured into the halls of expertry, you said, well, look, this isn't so bad because I'll be the expert on one side and they'll have an expert on the other side and it'll balance itself out. Do you think that ultimately it worked fairly for everybody to have the two experts balancing each other out?
Almost never it does. And for a couple of reasons. One is one expert is almost always better than the other. And so in our society, economic power tends to get that expert. So it's to the highest bidder, not always, but often.
So big business can buy more experts and better ones.
Sure.
What is the lesson here? When we see an expert on the news, how seriously should we take his or her opinion?
With a great big dash of salt.
Well, what if they went to Harvard?
Doesn't matter.
Well, Stephen Moss, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Stephen Moss is a partner with M-Cubed, a consulting firm. His story, Opinion for Sale, appears in the March-April edition of Legal Affairs.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Megan Ryan with Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, Scott Strickland, George Edwards, and Neil Golub. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Brian Tilley and Mark Herz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support from the media is provided by the Bydell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.